Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 82 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So announcements this week. We got a couple new shots from the Outlander Instagram account. It's pretty standard at this point for me to say there's a couple new shots. There's generally about two per week. This week we got one shot of a bunch of... I mean, there's a lot of tartan going around in this picture, and one of the dudes is clearly behind the scenes, but he has...
some kind of tartan on.
He's all kinds of tartan. Like, his coat is plaid, his hat is plaid, and he's holding a white phone, which tells me he's taking a picture of... And then with him is, of course, Jamie and Dougal, and that might be...
The hair's too stringy.
I think it's Rupert.
It might be Rupert.
It's hard to say because his hand, this plaid dude's hand is in the way, but it looks
which
like
plaid can't do. They're all plaid clad.
The dude in like the coat and hat and phone carrying dude. We also have a picture of a bunch of red coats hanging out on some grassy field next to a castle. Hard to say what it is, where it is. We have
it's probably Scotland.
You can't see it, but there was a giant eye roll right there. This week they also released how many were there?
I've gotten various accounts. I think between 22 and 29.
Good. Pictures?
Yes.
Good God, there were so many pictures released this week.
Early this week.
Yeah. Like, between 22 and 29. You heard it from G over there, from Ginger. 22 and 29. So many pictures of literally almost every cast member worth mentioning. And we posted them on our page, and they're also, like, you can find them anywhere. They're all over the place. The U.S. also got a new trailer featuring... Sam Heughan. It was a very Jamie-centric trailer. It's good. You should find it. It's all over the place. I'd give you one specific place, but I think everyone's posted it at this point. There was also an Ask Outlander this week. We haven't had one of these in a while.
Quite a while.
It's been a while. But this one was... I don't even want to say fan favorite, because I don't know if he'd be... Is he a fan favorite?
He's my fan favorite.
Okay. G's favorite, Tobias Menzies. Yes. Was the subject of this week's Ask Outlander. And it was, like, my phone was blowing up. And it was, I had constant, just, like, notifications of Tobias Menzies answering questions. So it was a very busy hour or two.
They always are. You can tell when something's going on. Either there's been a big announcement, some casting, or some new thing, or a Q&A.
This week, PaleyFest. Y'all. I wish we could have gone, but it was during the week, and I just couldn't get away. PaleyFest happened this week, and there was an epic Q&A with pretty much all the big baddies from the series. We got Katrina and Sam.
Big baddies.
Katrina, Sam, Ron Moore, Diana Gabaldon, and Tobias Menzies all at a round table, but they were all sitting next to each other. But there's a bunch of little, like, vignettes, like little scenes showing it happening, but the whole thing had been posted live and you could have watched it. The only thing that wasn't part of the live stream or part of anything that they let you see after the fact was the fact that everyone in the audience did get to see episode 109.
Mm-hmm. Which is very cool.
So cool. Again, wish I was there. And one of my favorite parts of the Paley Fest that I got to see was the host, I think her name is Kristen DeSantos from E! Online, posted it. It was, she did a Ne'er Have I Err, which is, you know, the cousin to Never Have I Ever, where if you have done something that she says Never Have I Ever, you take a drink. And she did it with the cast and crew, and they all had giant glasses of whiskey. And if you have a chance, go find it and watch it. I was in hysterics. And then the Amazon Video UK, so the Outlander, Amazon Prime UK, which is the Outlander distributor for the UK, posted a new video this week that they called it the quote-unquote journey trailer. Seriously, the ramp up for the UK getting this is so exciting for me because it's been so long coming.
Oh my gosh.
And lastly, the UK will be getting their own Outlander premiere events in London and Glasgow. They will both be on the 23rd of March. Very exciting. There will be a panel and a live stream of the event. So I'm so excited for the UK. Like, this is so big for us.
If there are...
Clearly.
Yes. And I know it... From what we understand, it was a...
You had to enter for a chance to attend one of the two premier events in the UK. Any listeners or fans, or, you know, spread the word if you know someone who ends up getting one of those lucky, I have a golden ticket.
Right? It's all Willy Wonka and stuff.
You know, let us know. We would love to hear from you. I don't know, maybe come and visit our podcast and let us know how it was, and we can have a wee chat maybe. We'd love to hear from you guys how it went, what your experience was like, and just all the fun and excitement, because we know exactly what it's like in a different realm, obviously, but we would love to hear from someone who's able to go.
And that is announcements. Now, on to the next segment of our episode. This one is another interview? Like, this has been...
Okay, March is the month of interviews.
I guess. Is this going to be our new thing? March is interview month?
No. Please no. And I just realized...
I would love that if we had March all interviews.
Well, May is whiskey month.
Oh, Lord.
May
I'm not
is,
ready.
No, May is Outlander. So, I mean, we're kind of making up for not doing it because we're going to Scotland. So we'll do whiskey pod every day.
We'll do enough whiskey pod in that 10 days we're in Scotland.
To make up for the miss.
To make up for... It will be posted every week in May.
Oh, yeah.
We'll do a little, at least a little whiskey pod.
Oh, whiskey pod?
Yeah.
Oh.
I have to.
We'll
it's the
see.
Month of whiskey.
Okay, we'll try.
I mean, everyone enjoys
and
it,
and Summer will
right?
barf, and I will laugh at her.
I will gag.
So, yes, we're very, very happy to share our interview with the Onset Herbalist consultant for Outlander, Claire Mackay. We would like to welcome Claire Mackay, the official Outlander herbalist on set. Claire, how are you?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you. And you?
We are very well.
Great.
And how fortunate it is, or how interesting it is, that your name is Claire.
Yes, it makes it very exciting.
Or does it make it confusing at times?
Sometimes, I have to say, my experience with Outlander was quite an intensive time because I hadn't read the books before I was asked to work on the series. And so I thought, well, I better start reading these books. And as soon as I opened the page and saw my name, I was just like, ooh, this is me. I've been intensively, you know, reading the books. I mean, somebody said to me that they had been reading the Outlander books for 15 years, and I read them all within about 8 months after the first one, and I've been studying them intensively and going back and forward between all the herbal scenes, and sometimes I do actually wake up in the night dreaming about Claire Fraser. And I do have moments where I think, okay, pinch yourself, you're actually not Claire Fraser.
Okay, so not Claire Fraser. We have to ask this question. Before yep. all of this started, when you were little, or when you first had your turn on, whatever turned you on to plants, why plants? When and how did your interest in plants begin?
Well, I think I've always been an outdoor child. You know, I actually have my first memory was when I was 3 years old, and my grandparents had taken me out in Fife, which is where I was born and where my early childhood was spent. And they were having a meal, and after the meal they were having a few drinks, and I followed a dog outside into this woodland area, and I continued to follow the dog, and I was lost for about 3 hours. Eventually, the dog abandoned me. And I had gone up this woodland glade into the hillside. And I have this vivid memory of being lost in the woods. And there was a burn there. And I was looking at the plants. And some people say, you know, I think there's scientifically, they're still not sure. There's not a consensus of when you can have memories, but I have this early childhood memory, and I remember so vividly being in the woods and looking around and just being in awe of what was around me. And I sat down at the base of this big tall pine tree. I was sort of crying, hoping somebody would find me, and eventually the dog brought my family back. But I still remember being in the woods and just feeling this sort of sense of awe for nature. And I was very much like that all throughout my childhood. You know, my mum would turn her back and I'd be off and climbing trees. And we lived in the countryside and I was always in the meadows, you know, playing role play in my head. I used to pretend that I was making flour out of grass seeds and crushing them between stones. And so I think I was a herbalist from a young age, really. I was just so curious about plants and nature, and I've always had that curiosity. And the other aspect was cooking. My mum's a great cook and I love to cook with her, and she loved, you know, we had a larder full of spices and dried herbs and things, and I loved cooking with her. So the curiosity was always there, but I hadn't really been exposed to herbal medicine in my childhood. That came later. When I was in my early 20s, I spent a year travelling around China and I was teaching English. And I got interested in holistic therapies while I was out there. And I also went to see a Chinese doctor and had a really significant experience out there. I was close to having pneumonia when I was in China, and because of the pollution. And the orthodox medicine was sort of not working very well. So I went to see a traditional healer. And I don't know what I took. It tasted disgusting. I had this bag, of you know, roots and things, and I had to boil it up and leave it to soak, and then had then strain it, and it was all quite exciting. And this really dark liquid formed, and I had to drink it. It was revolting, but it really worked quickly to heal me. And I had a bit of a curiosity, and when I came back from China, I went on to study aromatherapy and massage and reflexology and different alternative therapies. And it was really when I was studying aromatherapy, I got interested in the chemistry of plants. And I thought, oh my goodness, plants are used in everything. This is incredible. You know, I hadn't considered like the cosmetics, toiletries, perfume. You know, plants are really, really used abundantly, and I wanted to know more. And I worked in a herbal shop for a little while, and that's when I decided to go to university and study herbalism. So that was in 2004. I signed up to do a degree, and you know, it was really fascinating. The university I went to was called the Scottish School of Herbal Medicine, and it was a branch of the University of Wales. It was a strange setup, and we did our classes in this children's school at weekends. So we were going into this sort of children's school and sitting at these really small sort of tables for young children while I was studying. And it was a Waldorf school, so it was very colourful and bright, and so my experience of doing my degree wasn't like a lot of people. It was quite a fun experience. And I actually took a year out when my little boy was born, and I ended up going to finish my degree, doing my final degree at Edinburgh, and that was a big university, and very much an emphasis on the phytochemistry and the science behind herbs. So I got a sort of all round balanced education of herbs, and I finally graduated with my degree from Edinburgh. I'm a qualified medical herbalist.
That's pretty awesome. So your interest in exploring and discovery and plants and wildlife or creation followed you up until your early 20s, your late teens, and you decided to go and become qualified. I think that is amazing. Mm-hmm. Sir, what is your official title as herbalist? Is it a...
Yeah, I'm a medical herbalist.
Medical herbalist. Okay. To become a medical herbalist, is it do you have to have both of those qualifications, or the two types? Do you have to have the scientific chemistry background, as well as the both and the biology, as well as the
yes.
as well as the functional identification, concoction, working with the hands-on?
Yeah. Well, so my degree was a mix. So it's a Bachelor of Science degree. So we did the botany and the clinical science, like the clinical medicine and clinical examination, that is the same as what a GP, a general practitioner in the UK would do to some level, except that we don't learn about pharmaceuticals. We're learning about using herbs. But the diagnostics and the, you know, the anatomy, physiology, pathophysiology and differential diagnosis, that's all very much structured similarly to the medical teachings that a doctor would, somebody studying medicine would study a similar course. And then we had botany, and we had to do plant identification, both dried specimens and living specimens. So we were tested on identification of dried plants, dried and cut plants. So we had to look through lenses at bits of dried plant and try and identify them. And it's really quite a challenging degree course, because there's a lot to it. And then the other side is that we were learning, as well as the chemistry of the plants and how they work in the body, and some of that is a little like studying pharmacy, because you have to understand the actions of different chemicals. But there were elements of going into the woods and sitting in nature, trying to get a sense of the plants, and also we learned about different energy systems, like in Ayurveda in India, they have different ideas about the energetic system of the body, and in traditional Chinese medicine they have similar things. So it was a well-rounded sort of degree course.
It sounds extremely well-rounded. Wow. Pharmacology, organic chemistry, quite involved.
So the you had asked about, what training do you need? And that's actually, at the moment, there is the kind of, we're at a threshold at the moment where there technically in the UK isn't, there's a sort of voluntary register that you can opt to be part of. But it's a little bit of a vague area, herbalism, because while the standard of the moment seems to be that you go to university and get a degree, which is a 4-year degree, to become a medical herbalist, there's really no restrictions as to who call themselves a medical herbalist. So in the Highlands, for instance, you still have not very many, but there are still people who use herbs and treat people who have retained this knowledge or learned from their granny or, you know, their mum, and who haven't had any sort of education as such, conventional education. And a lot of the older generation of herbalists maybe have been practicing for 40 years, might not have a degree, but they have a lot of skill and experience. So at the moment, I think in terms of politics within the herbal world, there's a lot going on to try and standardize who can call themselves a herbalist and what is the requirement of practice and an assessment in order to be a herbalist. But it's still quite a vague area at the moment, and there's quite a diverse bunch, because you get a lot of people who are herbalists that are very interested in the phytochemistry and the chemicals and how the chemicals of the plants work, but you also get a lot of people that are still using the traditional remedies and the sort of the folk medicine that's been passed down through generations, and maybe from the travellers and the gypsies and that kind of thing. So there's herbalists are a very diverse bunch of people.
Well, it's not something that's regulated like medicine is. So, I mean, are you required to carry like malpractice insurance or anything like that for what you do?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I'm insured as a practitioner. So the law doesn't call for it. And there are people that, you know, I mean, it's technically possible to practice without insurance. But I would say that's unethical. If you're going to be treating people or claiming to be treating people, then of course you should have insurance. And that's when the sort of self-regulatory area of herbalism comes in, because people who are practicing and have insurance, I think most insurance companies will call for a minimum qualification. So there is a sort of standardization when you start getting into insurance practices, but it's still a very much unregulated area. Mm-hmm. At the moment. And there's different, politically, there's different camps of people. So there's some people who are pushing for tighter regulations because they want to be accepted by the current health system and seen in the same status as doctors and medical professionals. And there are other people that don't want to be further regulated, because then we'll be looking at people from orthodox medicine regulating herbal medicine. And some people think that there's a conflict of interest there, and that herbalism needs to be regulated by herbalists. So, I mean, this has been something that's going through the motions of debate at the moment for the past 10 years, I think, and even longer. So It's not really a new thing. This has come up in history time and time again of, well, how do we regulate herbal medicine? Because in some ways it's so ancient, but in a lot of ways there's a movement towards contemporary herbalism, which is on the territory of becoming like modern medicine. You know, some herbal medicines are really just like herb drugs when you look at them, and you need to have responsibility in how you use them. So
it's really not an old kind of issue. It comes up again and again. And I think you're right. As in different societies, as more traditional forms of healing want to become more popular, more primetime news, more light is shed on it, or they become more mainstream, then as the interest is there, then people, understandably so, want to see it become part of their, regulated, yes, but want to see it as part of their health options, yeah, their treatment options. But in order to do that, it has to become more standardized, and in order to become more standardized and more regulated, you need things like, the questions come up, okay, well, will our or must our medicinal herbalists, for example, in the UK or in Scotland at least, must they have qualified with the BSc?
Yeah.
If someone with an herbal knowledge, you know, can they treat someone? Will they be covered by insurance? And in most places, the answer is no.
Yep.
But yeah, it's an ongoing thing. And I think it's kind of not a catch-22, but it's kind of something that you kind of have to be open. I mean, ultimately, in order to have all of the health choices, part of its acceptance of its legitimacy is to include it along with other treatments. And in order to do that, there has to be slightly more regulation until, as people become more accepting of it.
Yeah. Well, it's a strange time, because, you know, there are places in Europe where you cannot practice as a herbalist. And
oh my gosh.
I think in Switzerland, only a registered medical doctor can prescribe herbs. I'm not sure if this is the truth, but as far as I know, there's certainly restrictions in Canada as well. And from what you've just said there, it sounds like in the States, and I think there are, I'm not sure if it varies from different state to state, but I know that there are restrictions that are different to the UK. And then you have places like Iceland and Sweden, where they still have a very strong love of the use of herbal medicines, and they still use traditional remedies like pine tea, which is making tea an infusion from the needles of pine trees. Now, that's something that would have been done traditionally in Scotland as well, but I don't know many people in the Highlands that are doing that from tradition. So it's interesting, and I spent some time in Africa last year. I was living in West Africa in Burkina Faso, and I was working with traditional plant medicines there. And Burkina Faso is the third poorest country in the world, and it doesn't have a primary health care system. You know, we don't realise I'm very grateful for the access that we have to healthcare in the West. And you really get a sense of that when you go somewhere where there isn't any healthcare. And I find myself a bit like Claire, almost going back in time. My son had a head injury, and it was a wound that required stitches, but there was literally nowhere to have proper medical care, and I found myself treating this you know, in a rather rustic manner, and I thought, my goodness, that just wouldn't happen in the UK, because you would go to a doctor or a nurse or a practice or the hospital and be seen. And I had to use plant medicine. And that happened on a few occasions when we were out there. And what you realise is that when you go to places where there is no healthcare and the people are so poor that they can't afford pharmaceuticals, you find that the herbs are much more in use. I think there's 2/3 of the population of the world still rely on herbal medicines as their main source of healthcare. But those are very different worlds. You know, in the States or in the West and in the UK, I think we have much more access to all kinds of substances. And there's also a very commercial aspect where you can walk into a pharmacy or a health store and buy things. And you can also start up your own company and sell products. So we have access to so many substances. And I think, yeah, there needs to be control over that, and there needs to be some sort of standardization. But I thought it was amazing in Africa. And I think back in time, you know, we have more of a sense of liability here. There's more of an onus for the practitioner. But when you look back in time, you know, and looking in the books, some of the scenes, you know, you wouldn't recreate them in this age. But I think back in time, there was this sort of respect for the doctor or the healer. And it was sort of, diseases were much more serious then. And the slightest injury or wound or illness could become fatal. And people pat their lives in the hands of these healers, their doctors or their herbalists. And it was kind of like, well, this will either cure you or kill you. And people kind of took that in their stride, you know. I think people were just like, well, okay, that's the way it is. But nowadays, I don't think that attitude is still there. But I did notice in Burkina Faso that there was more of an attitude of being prepared to try anything and using these herbs. And at the same time, you get all these charlatans as well. You know, there's the real charlatans out there that are selling the snake oil to desperate people. And you just look at what's happening and think, this is terrible. This can't be happening. You know, poor people being sold all sorts of concoctions, believing it's going to make them better. And it's a fine line, I think, between preserving the roots of the tradition of herbal medicine and also protecting people's rights, basically, people's human rights.
So you have mentioned that you have read all the books, but when you became involved with the production, yep, you had not yet read the books, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And how quickly, okay, number one, before you actually started work with Outlander,
yep,
and you were preparing, how many of the books were you asked to look at, or did you want to look at and study before you actually tackled the new job?
Well, so yeah, I was, I hadn't read any of the books, and about the year before I found out about Outlander, my best friend, you know, she had been reading this book, and she was going on and on about it, and she kept telling me, oh, Claire, you must read this book, if, you know, this book is practically written for you. And then I was just sort of saying, yeah, I'm really busy just now, I'll get around to it. But it was one of these things she had mentioned and it had gone out of my head. And so I was contacted by the production team and asked to go and be a herbal consultant. And they gave me a bit of the background and said, have you heard of this series? And I said, well, she mentioned Outlander. And of course, in the UK, the first book is Cross Stitch. So I mm-hmm. said, no, I've not heard of Outlander. So I looked it up and I quickly found out what was happening and who Ronald D. Moore was, and I was a bit dumbstruck. Why are they looking for a herbalist in the Highlands? Anyway, I went and I found out more, and I was asked to join the production team, and I was given the first book to read. So I was really actually only obliged to read the first book for, you know, season one. But when I started, I couldn't put it down.
Of course you couldn't.
I was like up, you know, all night. And my husband was getting a bit like, okay, you're working too hard, you know, come to bed. Like, don't be silly. You don't need to work this hard. And I'm like, no, it's okay. I don't mind. I really want to. Yeah, that first book is really, it just like hooks you right from the beginning. And like I say, you know, seeing my name as well, there was something, I know this affects everybody in this way. All of the Outlanders that I've met have the same sense of the books, but also seeing my name, and you know, it really makes it kind of more personal. And also just the use of herbs, because I was just really hooked, because, you know, as if there's not enough to hook you, but my absolute passion is the herbs. And I just love how Diana describes the scenery. You know, she really builds a great image of the outdoors, and I was really, it was easy for me just to go back in time and imagine that I was there. And so I really developed a love of Outlander right from the beginning. And I wasn't even, you know, I just thought, well, I'm working on this, but it wasn't even a job to me. I just thought, I need more. And that was me. I focused on the first book as I was working, as they were filming the first season. I was really sort of focused on pulling out the herbal scenes and going back and forward. And it got a bit confusing, actually, because I'd be skipping back and forward out of the flow of the book. So I got a bit jumbled up to begin with. But yeah, no, I knew that I was going to go on and read more. And so I did. And I worked on the first season, and then my husband got a job in Burkina Faso, and I got to work on a project to do with folk medicine and traditional medicine in Africa. So I went to Africa armed with the next 7 books and proceeded to go through them. And then it was actually quite disturbing for me, because I normally, you know, I'm totally at home in the Highlands. This is where I belong, and I love being here. All of my herbal expertise is in the Highland tradition of herbal medicine. And here I was reading these books in Africa, in the desert, just pining wishing I could get on a plane and get back to Inverness. I was reading them in Africa, which was quite ironic because I just wanted to go to all the places in the books.
Was this your first time consulting for a television series?
Yes, it was. I've consulted for various projects before and for local councils and people organising charities and different things, but this was the first time that I'd worked with a television programme.
So as much as you were able to tell us, what was a typical day on set?
Well, a lot of my work was done offset. A lot of mine was sort of, you know, checking for accuracy in the writing and just following the storylines as they were being scripted and doing whatever research was involved with that particular episode. And that was fascinating. I was, you know, basically researching my passion, which is the Highland tradition of herbal medicine, and getting into the Outlander stories and getting paid for it. It was like a dream job, so to speak. And then I was sort of starting before they were even casting, you know, the actors. And then really I had to meet with Kate, and I met with her to discuss, you know, just to get the authentic feel for a herbalist. We spoke about different herbs that were used or different herbs that were mentioned, the pronunciation of certain things and different applications for the herbs. So a lot of the work was done with the writers and the actual scripts and the research behind the scenes, so to speak, and a little bit of involvement with the making sure that with the arts team and building the garden, for instance, I had a little bit of input there and advising on what herbs would have been growing and what would have been used. And that was nice, creating a garden, because that's obviously a love of mine. Is as well as being a herbalist, I'm actually a lover of growing plants, and creating this garden that was, or having input into that garden that was going to be part of the Outlander set was quite a nice thing to do. And then there was the surgery, you know, the apothecary, and there was a little bit of input into that as well, and keeping things authentic to the time period.
So one of the things that was, or one of the things, I guess, story points that was different in the series than the book was the introduction of wood garlic versus lily of the valley.
Yeah.
Was that something that the writers brought to you, or did they come to you and say, we need a poisonous plant that we could find here that maybe wasn't there but would find a good historic reason for it to be there?
Yeah, so I didn't actually have, you know, the writers wrote the storyline. But yeah, I did have input in that, so it was interesting where they came to me with their storylines. And really, I was just there to say, is this plausible? You know, would this have been growing at the time? And, you know, it was really interesting. But of course, the writers, they had the full credit of the storyline. And mm-hmm. I was really just there to bounce things off of, which was the case with that episode.
So what do you think was your most challenging part of your work on Outlander?
Challenging? I don't think it was challenging. I really enjoyed the whole lot of it. Probably the most challenging thing was keeping up with the pace of it. I had no idea that TV productions were so fast-paced. You know, I was like given three scripts or something at a time and said, right, make your way through these for next week.
Wow.
And, so there was quite fast paced, and then lots of going back and forward, editing things, and you know, you're maybe working on a couple of scripts at a time, so trying to keep track of the changes. And so that was the most challenging aspect. And apart from that, the research and everything. It was my passion anyway. And like I said, getting paid to read Outlander was quite a joy, really.
Do you think you may provide ongoing consultative work for the production as long as the herbs or medicinal herbalism related is in or around Scotland or the UK?
No, I finished up the season one, you know, at the end of last year, and then I had to go to Africa. So I've not currently been asked to work on season two, and at the moment I've moved on to writing the Outlander herbal, and Diana has asked me kindly to contribute to the Outlandish Companion, the second volume. So that's out in October, and I'm really busy at the moment trying to write the Outlander herbal and the second volume. And I'd be very happy if they asked me. I'm not sure when the season two will begin, but I'm not currently working on the TV sets at the moment.
What does your own garden look like? And if it's not the same, describe your ideal garden, the garden of your dreams.
Well, I returned back from Africa in January. Before we went, I was managing a beautiful garden, a native medicinal herb nursery in the Highlands here, and that was really quite a privilege, because this garden it's 35 years old. It's a beautiful walled garden. There's over 250 species of native medicinal Scottish plants and some very rare ones. And there's nowhere else in the country that has this variety of medicinal plants. So that was really quite special being there. And from working with those plants and the experience there, I started a herbal tea company. And the name is Slánchuk, which means in Gaelic, in good health. And the idea is to have Scottish native traditional herbal teas that perhaps have gone out of fashion or are not popular anymore, and to really revive the use of some of the Scottish wild plants. And so at the moment I am in the process of starting to grow different species of native plants for the tea company. So that's not really my ideal garden as such. It's more of a commercial garden for the purpose of tea blends. But I'm in the process of speaking just now with some organisations about reviving the heritage aspect of herbal medicine in the Highlands. And one of the things that is revolving around this, and I've been working on this plan for about a year, I had the notion of creating an Outlander garden, so to speak, a sort of physics garden with herbal medicines of the Highlands. And so we're looking at the possibility of having a kind of herbal history centre, which would be a physic garden with all the medicinal plants that you can walk around, and as you walk around you'll see the medicinal plants, and there'll be plaques that tell you, a little bit like a botanical garden, but really centering on the medicinal plants of the Highlands. And so my ideal garden would be an educational garden that is, you know, that where people can come and walk around and touch the plants, smell the plants, and also learn about them, learn about their Gaelic names, learn about how they were used in history. And that's my kind of dream and dream. We're discussing a venue for this at the moment, and ideally somewhere central that people can come and it will also be a centre for the heritage aspects of herbal medicine.
If someone were interested in learning more about herbs, or growing them, but maybe feeling overwhelmed at where to start, what would you suggest that someone do? What would be the best or easiest way to get started?
Well, I know that depending on where you are, I know that there's a few online or distance learning courses that you can do just as a beginner. There's a couple in the States, as far as I know. And I think, unless they're not no longer doing it, the University of East London in the UK was doing a distance learning degree course. But for somebody that just wanted to, you know a little bit more for their own purposes, I would recommend getting to know, to begin with, just a good practical herb book or a good herbal or an encyclopedia of herbal medicine, and really just start to work with the medicinal properties of some of the ingredients that you might have in your kitchen, for instance. You know, get to know a lot of early herbal remedies were made use of, you know, what was around, what was growing in the garden, what was available, what was growing, what were you using in the kitchen? Simple things like honey and, you know, onion. An early cough medicine would have been like chopped onion in some honey, and you leave it for a couple of hours and it becomes like a kind of syrup, and the honey takes on the chemicals and the scent and the aroma of the onion, and it's really effective for a cough. So I would start getting to know, like, really maybe like 20 sort of really common herbs or common ingredients in your kitchen, and learn what you can use them for. And then actually the important thing is to start using them, because a lot of people read herbs can get quite complicated, and you can go into the chemistry and you can learn all the different families and you can learn, you know, hundreds of exotic herbs from all over the world, but until you actually start doing something practical with them, it's hard to get a sense of how they work. So I would say maybe grow 10 herbs in your garden that can be used in cooking or as herbal tea. Learn how to make a syrup or vinegar. You know, you can make like an infusion in vinegar. One that's very good for circulation is some capsicum pepper in some vinegar. And you can make your own infusion of that and take it over winter, a spoonful a day, and it's quite good for giving the circulation a boost and good for inflammation and things like that. So get yourself a good book on basic remedies and then just start using them. You know, instead of buying peppermint tea from the supermarket, get yourself a peppermint plant and pick a few leaves every day and put it in some hot water and make a blend of herbal tea and just feel the difference. There's an amazing vibrancy to using fresh herbs and fresh plant as opposed to the dried sort of spices that you'll get in the supermarket. So that would be my advice for someone that was just looking for basic ideas about herbs. And then if you have an interest in going further, you could start by looking at botany. It's really important, and I would say anybody that wants to use herbs on a deeper medicinal level, the first you need to do is make sure that you know how to identify herbs. I don't know if I need to say it, but I will as a disclaimer. There are lots of poisonous herbs out there, lots of potential medicines that can also do damage. So first rule in using herbs is that if you don't know what it is, then, you know, go and find out. Make sure that you know what you're taking before you do anything. There are herbs that look similar that could potentially cause you harm if used inappropriately. So I would say go and seek a professional or somebody that can teach you and make sure you really know what you're doing before you start going into using herbs on a more medical basis.
What about your free time, which I'm sure with your own business and a child and your own family that you have so much free time. What do you like to do in your spare time?
Well, in my free time, I do pretty much all of the things that I do when I'm working. I really am doing what I love, and I think the difference is that I actually go outdoors in my free time. I'm a great lover of the outdoors. I love hill walking. When I'm not writing about herbs or sitting in front of a computer researching herbs, then I'm out looking for them. I am constantly walking and rambling the countryside all over Scotland looking for medicinal plants, and I and I never sort of seem to shut off from that. In fact, when I was in Italy, my husband's Italian, and I was visiting my in-laws, and we went for a walk, and I think they were puzzled as to why I looked down from the minute we got out the car, and during the conversation my eyes were constantly darting about looking for plants. So it's really my passion, and that's what I like to do. I like to hill walk, and I like to you know, get outside in nature. Basically, I like to be by the sea, and I'm constantly on the search for plants that I don't know. A bit of a plant hunter.
So regarding some upcoming projects or other things that you are working on, you've mentioned a few. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, well, so at the moment, the Outlander Herbal is the book that I'm writing at the moment, and it's going to be a book in three sections, and the three sections are going to tie in with the Outlander novels. The first section is really a historic basis for the herbal use in the Highlands of Scotland, and so it's going to read a bit like a timeline and a herbal history of herbal use in the Highlands of Scotland within the time frame of Outlander. And then there's going to be a Materia Medica, which is all of the materials and herbs mentioned in the books, and a little bit about them, what they're used for, what they were used for traditionally, and how they're used, if they're used, in modern times. And then the last section of that book is going to be a sort of practical how-to guide on how to use herbal medicines, and it will discuss some of the ways that they're used in the books, but also in a modern sense, how you can apply the use of herbs in your daily life in a safe way. And there'll be some recipes and basic practical advice. That's taking up a large chunk of my time at the moment, and I'm also contributing to the second volume of the Outlandish Companion, which is based on the last four books in the series. And I'm writing again in relation to the herbs used and the history of the herbs. Out with that, I am currently in the beginning of starting up an Outlander exhibition, which we are in the process of finding a date for at the moment, and there's a choice of venues, and we're trying to decide which is going to be the best venue for that. The Outlander exhibition is going to be an exhibition based on the factual history of the Outlander, the first book, and also the herbs used and the history of the herb. There's going to be a garden space with samples of the herbs for people to actually see, and we're hoping that will be up and running by summer. These things take a little bit of organizing, so I'm still unsure if that's going to be the case, but I will keep you informed and let you know when we get a date set in stone for the exhibition. And I'm also, in the summer, going to be doing some practical workshops. I'll be listing those on my website soon, but during the summer I'm going to be doing some events, herb walk. I'm going to be at Kuros Palace, the place where the garden, the herb garden at the castle was set, and I'm going to be showing people around the gardens there and describing the use of the herbs from scenes in Outlander. And I'm also going to be doing a little bit of collaboration with Visit Scotland. So I'm on my way over to New York for the Tartan Week, and promoting a bit of the heritage aspects of Outlander. So promoting the history of herbal medicine in Scotland. And I'm very happy that Visit Scotland are taking an interest in the sort of tourism aspects of Outlander, and they're really keen to promote some of the historic places, but also some of the heritage behind the Outlander series. So Diana has really done an amazing thing for for Scotland and promoting the history and the heritage of Scotland. So I'm very grateful to her for that. But that's what I'm going to be doing in the summer. So we've got the exhibition and working alongside Visit Scotland in promoting some of the heritage aspects, and then giving some workshops relating to Outlander in the late summer.
So yeah, you're not busy at all.
Just a little bit. Oh, yeah, and I'm going to be at the Outlandish Gathering in the UK in May as well. So I'm going to be speaking there and possibly giving a few talks at some of the venues, of the actual real-life venues from the Outlander books, but that's still to be arranged. So there will be dates coming soon on my website.
that sounds amazing, and
we're all a bit TBC at the moment, to be confirmed.
Yes, absolutely. So you mentioned the Outlandish Companion 2, and that was specifically for the second four books.
Yeah,
the biggest portion of your experience is in traditional Scottish herbs in the Highland, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Have you ever been to America? Or how do you then do your research on the Native American plants?
Yeah, I have. I have been to America, but not... It was before I was a herbalist. And not... You know, I wasn't there on that. I was there on holiday. So that was a bit of a challenge for me as a herbalist. Because I don't know the pharmacopoeia of America very well. My main expertise is in the UK, and particularly in the Highlands of Scotland. So there are amazing resources. I don't know if you know Ellingwood Pharmacopoeia of America. There's a woman who has a herbal database online, which you can access as a researcher. Her name is Henrietta Cress, and I think you can also pay to have this as a CD. And she has documented out of date and old herbal references, well, from lots of places, but many of the American early pharmacopoeias are on there. And there's written to people. Like the Hudson's Bay have a pharmacy museum who've been very helpful in providing information about the Native Americans' medicines, and I've done some research in the National Library over here as well. But that was quite challenging to begin with, to link in the historic elements and the timelines that are running parallel in the Highlands of Scotland and America. And there was actually a little breakthrough when I realised that, you know, after the clearances and a lot of the immigrants from Scotland going to the States, there was a transfer of medicines at that point, and the medicines and folk medicines were absorbed into the culture. And then things like I'm writing about pine just now. And of course, pine grows all over the world, and it was so useful to the Scots, and they used it in so many ways. And then, you know, there's the plantations and the turpentine and so on. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. Is this a spoiler?
The plantations?
Yeah, like later books. But
yeah, we didn't. It's definitely in later books. And in our read-along, we've only gotten to chapter 19.
Okay.
Or by the time this airs, it might be chapter 20. Actually, no. Excuse me. We would have gotten to at least 19. I'll put it that way. But we're solidly in Dragonfly and Amber. So as long as we're not giving any storyline away, the book, in book one, it's already alluded to the fact that Culloden happened.
Yep.
And after Culloden happens, a lot of people aren't there.
Yeah.
And if they're not there, they're going to be somewhere else. So in, early on in Dragonfly and Amber, we can say this much. Brianna comes from America.
Yeah.
So there's... I think it's okay.
Yeah.
And that has to happen somehow.
Yeah. So there's an interesting... There was an interesting connection there with the immigrants from Scotland. And it was really interesting, the meeting of two worlds and looking at the remedies from the indigenous, you know, Native Americans, and then the native Scots, and looking for a common ground, and then, you know, looking in some places and thinking, oh, okay, so they use aspen here, but they use poplar in the States, and these two are, you know, quite similar. Or so, you know, because as a herbalist, you learn about plant chemicals and you learn about plant families, and you get a sense of, you know, I have a general sense that can be applied to all medical practices, herbal medical practices. But obviously the plants were really new to me. But it's been fascinating, really fascinating, deepening on that research and learning about the, you know, the Native Americans, and yeah, and just how many different Indians there were, you know. I've been particularly looking into the Cree Indians, but it's fascinating looking at the different traditions, and then also seeing the similarities in some of the remedies that were used as well.
Now, did you mentioned the plantation, which of course, even though it's not on the ground, it would have had at some point African influence. Did you have to look into any of that?
No, I haven't. I haven't included that. And well, I was in Africa. I haven't gone there. In my section for the Outlandish Companion is going to be She's. I don't know if you've seen the recent list of the contents of that book, but it contains a lot of information.
Yes.
the herbs. To put it into perspective, the herbs are only one of the contributions of section 10, so it's going to be a fairly brief encounter. Wow. And trying to fit in what's really relevant or important or pertinent is you know, crucial to... I'm trying to get as much juice in there as possible. And
absolutely.
So I haven't touched on the African influence yet, and it's possible that it might come in there. And I have actually got a lot of... I spent 8 months in Burkina Faso looking into African medicine, and I'm quite familiar with the African pharmacopoeia, and I was focused on West African medicine, and there are some parallels and overlap there, and that may still come.
Well, it would be interesting. Whenever you are able to, whenever you think you may dabble into that, please just let us know, because that would be fascinating to read about as well.
Great. Well, it may be that it doesn't make it into the Outlandish Companion, and it may be that it's included in the Outlander Herbal, which will have more... it will be more spacious.
Yes. You also mentioned in some of our conversation earlier this week that you were looking to getting awareness for Gaelic manuscripts relating to medicine of the 16th century that need translation. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. How did I manage to not mention that?
That's what we're here for.
When I graduated, I was interested in looking at the writs, because you look at in India, and they've preserved the sort of origins of their medical system, and the same in China. And really in the Gaelic tradition, in the Highlands, a lot has been lost or buried, or, you know, there seem to be big gap in herbal medicine, especially. There seem to be like folk medicines that without really a basis or an understanding of why they existed. And I got really curious to know more. So I started looking for literature, and I spent a long time, the herbal reference, the reference library in Inverness, and various other little libraries with chaotic reference sections, like a little library somewhere close to us in the Highlands that has an uncatalogued reference section. And I go there and they just open these cabinets. They're locked. They're under lock and key, and they open them up and say, okay, help yourself, have a look. And I say, is there a catalogue? And they say, no. And I just look at all these shelves and think, my goodness. So I've came across some real treasures, but I started to realise, actually, there's a whole wealth of resources. You know, there's a whole wealth of books and literature that has never seen the light of day in centuries. And I got to know about the Beatons, who we all know from Davy Beaton and his cabinet in the surgery apothecary. And I got to know about the Beatons' manuscripts, which are a vast collection in the National Library. And I started looking through the online catalogue, and I noticed that there are numerous manuscripts that are in Gaelic that have never been translated. And so I got really interested in this idea of this knowledge, you know, just sitting there, not ever having been translated into English. And I thought, well, that's amazing. And I started looking, and there's some 16th century texts that are relating to medical use. That's the only note that is associated with those records. And I thought, well, if you're talking 16th century, you're talking about herbal medicine. So I became really excited and thought, right, we've got to get these translated. And then I'm not a Gaelic speaker. I was born in the Lowlands, and although I've had exposure to Gaelic, I'm not a speaker. So I thought, right, I've got loads of friends that speak Gaelic. I'm going to see if we can get these translated. And I realised it's not that simple, because you're talking about a sort of archaic form of Gaelic, which requires a scholar. But then you're also looking for somebody that's got a sort of basis of vocabulary that covers botanical references, somebody that knows the names of the plants at that time period, and somebody that has an idea of some of the medical terms. So it became a sort of mission for me to try and raise awareness. And I spoke to a lot of people, and there were a lot of people with potential leads to getting these manuscripts looked at. But it was going to require a bit of funding or a bit more organisation. And so we're now in the place where it looks like that's now going to happen. And I'm speaking with researchers at the moment, and hopefully something will come together in the coming months, and we'll be able to look at these Beatons manuscripts. But anybody can go and have a look. There's fascinating things in that collection, and you can go to the National Library in Edinburgh to the special collections, the manuscript section. If you ask to look at the Beaton manuscripts, there's fascinating things there. There's early health documents with depictions of the astrological signs and different things. It's quite a fascinating place to go and look at.
Well, it sounds like you have, again, no plans for the future and and absolutely nothing to do in your spare time. So I am so happy that we can help you. No, it sounds fascinating. And isn't it exciting to be doing something that you're passionate about? As you said, be paid to do something you're passionate about and have pretty much endless projects that will carry you through so many years.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, when I became a herbalist, I just wanted to go deeper into the history and find out, you know, where did this all come from? That was my real interest. And it looks like I can be doing that for a long time into the future. So there's certainly a lot to be going on with at the moment. And yeah, I'm really happy to have found Outlander. Not only has it given me an opportunity to do what I love and to keep doing what I love, but it's really turned me into an absolute fan of Diana Gabaldon. I'm really in awe of the series and the way she writes. And I can't imagine the inside of the workings of her mind. She must have such clear thinking, because the way she organizes the books and the storylines and everything it's pretty special. And it's really nice to see, you know, a piece of fiction that is fairly well researched and historically accurate. And yeah, I think there's a lot of people in Scotland right now very, very thankful for the Outlander series.
Well, Claire, we've had a ball. we always love it when we get to interview someone who's not just interested in the books and in the series and in the show and in
and is Scottish
and well of course and is Scottish, because the accent always helps. We're not gonna lie.
Yeah.
But your knowledge, obviously, your experience, your involvement, of course, with the show and consultative purposes capacity, it's amazing. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing so much with us and with our listeners.
Well, thank you for having me. And I look forward to speaking again. And if I'm around when you are over for your Scottish trip, then look me up and come by for a cup of herbal tea.
Love to. We would absolutely love to. Now, Claire, how would someone get in touch with you? Could you tell us your contact information?
Yep, absolutely. So on Twitter, I am Outlander Herbal. And you can follow me on Twitter. My website is where I have regular blog posts on the herbs used in herbal tradition of the Highlands, but also referring to the Outlander books, and that is outlanderherbal.com. And you will find me on Facebook as The Outlander Herbalist. And if you want to email me, you can email me at theoutlanderherbalist@gmail.com.
Excellent. So thank you so much, Claire, for spending your valuable time with us. And as you said, we would absolutely love to have you back in the future.
Thank you. Well, have a good weekend, what's left of it.
Oh my God, she was so delightful.
She was amazing. I would love to speak with her again and just pick her brain.
Not even about Outlander. I mean, Outlander stuff was fascinating, but I don't even need to talk to her about that. I mean, I'm just...
Someone's like, herbs, yeah.
Did I say it like that? Did I
No,
pray?
I did.
Did I pray? It's herbs. Yeah,
I didn't pray.
That's what you just did.
Oh, well, no. Anyway, I didn't do that.
You should have. So again, thank you so much, Claire McKay, for spending some time with us.
A huge thank you to our audio host, audioboom.com. And we love hearing from you. Let us know what you think. Leave us a comment on our blog, on Facebook, or on iTunes. As always, thank you so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod, or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com. That my young love